This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I have $100 for you, okay? Just like I promised, okay? You remember me, right? From the parking lot? We were filming with the white van, the guys in the white van. I was with them. You had those tiny cans, right? You had those tiny cans. Hey, hi, hi.
Hey, girls.
How you doing? Okay, it's okay.
You know this guy?
No, he booked us.
They do know me. They do know me. No, they do. We don't know each other well, but they know me.
It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay. Come on. Come on.
It's okay. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's gonna happen.
Yeah. Okay, okay. Yes.
Wait, right here.
No.
For a while.
You don't understand.
All right.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and I make sure to repeat any moments of spontaneity so that they're captured correctly for the cameras. Joining me today is Patrick Klepek.
And I, too, like to hang out in cars just counting my cash.
Today on Decoding TV, we're going to be discussing The Curse, Episode 3, Questaline. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the podcast or the show, The Curse, which is streaming right now on Paramount Plus and Showtime. We're also available on all platforms, YouTube and TikTok and Instagram at Decoding TV. As usual, we're going to start with our overall thoughts on this episode and then move into a detailed recap and review. I do want to give a shout out to a couple of other things going on Decoding TV. We are planning to cover, we did some coverage of The Murder at the End of the World, the first two episodes, and we'll be covering the finale of that show when it airs on This Week in Streaming. Also planning to cover Invincible Season 2. And probably, if we can make it work, an episode of The Crown with my wife, because we covered The Crown last year when it aired, the last season. So we'll try to get an episode of that out on the feed as well. So lots to look forward to here on Decoding TV. But let's get into the episode. Patrick Klepek, The Curse, Episode 3, Questaline. What were your overall thoughts on this episode?
It's interesting because the show, very naturally, for being, I think it's 9 or 10 episodes for the season, at some point has to shift into a different gear, right? So I think the first two episodes of the show, for, it's not like a high speed show, but like I think for the mode, the pacing of the show, it's doing a lot of setting things up, putting things in motion, getting you a sense of these characters. And then the question for me is, you know, we've spent a lot of time, especially talking about different like franchise shows, stuff coming from Lucasfilm and Marvel. It's like, what is the medium of TV offer you? Like, it's time. And then the question is, what do you do with that time? And so my question with The Curse has been, what's going to happen in this middle stretch? Like, where you can really luxuriate with these characters, where you can really spend time with them, where you're not, you're in this moment where we're entering sort of like the middle-ish of the season, where we're done with the setup and we haven't begun the escalation for the conclusion. So what are we doing with those characters in between? And so, you know, I quite enjoyed this episode, even though I think by Curse standards, it's maybe a little mellower than like is cringy, but less cringy on like the cringe scale than maybe you and I have become accustomed to over the first two. And so it's just, I think it's like it's a very solid episode of The Curse. I like in the three episode rankings, like I don't think it quite like hits the highs of the previous two, but it's getting into the ebb and flow of a normal show. And I'm so curious to see where that ends up. And I also really like the fact that this ends up being an episode very Asher centric. You know, one of the things that I think we ended our discussion on the previous episode was, oh, like it really seems like the main character of the show might end up being Whitney. And I think that could still remain the case, but it is not as though the show is leaving Asher behind. It is not as though Asher is a one-dimensional character, kind of a punching bag, sort of a presence in the curse. There's a lot more going on with this character. We're given much more opportunities to see this character react to various situations. And I increasingly, it feels like the conclusion of this episode is a lot of, boy, you're setting, like, a lot of landmines are being set. I don't know who's going to step on them. I don't know what limbs are going to blow off as a result. But, like, these mines are going to be stepped on at one point. And I mean, like, that's, my sense is that's a lot of where this show is going, is just like, ooh, ah, and then eventually some measure of fireworks. And I'm excited to see the show continue down that path.
All great points. I think this episode continues to showcase the amazing work of Emma Stone in particular. Like we talked about it last episode, but like what I think is really amazing about The Curse is, I'll put this out there. Did you ever watch Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson? You know,
It's been a minute, but yeah.
There is a moment in Boogie Nights when Mark Wahlberg's character is trying to become a musician. And so he sings that song like, he will rock you, you know, like, and he will burn you or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I remember listening to Paul Thomas Anderson's commentary and he's saying, this is really good acting of bad singing. Because you believe that it is him doing that bad singing. And the level of difficulty of what they're attempting on the show, I think, is very high. Where, and like, really, the ending of this episode, I think, is like a tour de force of acting. Because you need to have people have what appears to be a spontaneous moment, not to get ahead of ourselves, but mm-hmm. have what appears to have a spontaneous moment, and then try to recreate that spontaneous moment, but it comes off as not spontaneous anymore. And the human eye and mind is very attuned to the authenticity of a moment like that. And yet this show is able to pull it off convincingly. And I just think, like, this show has people behaving awkwardly, and it's difficult to have a show where you're trying to achieve, this is a human behaving awkwardly as opposed to an actor portraying a human behaving awkwardly, right? Like, in one scenario, you can sense the artifice. And in this show, I feel like they try to make that artifice go away. And you're just watching people, like fully fleshed out people, react as they normally would. And I think that's really impressive.
Well, it's a performance on top of a performance, right? Like, there's a world where the first layer of acting, which is just, you know, people performing a script, can work or not work for an audience. And then you have them performing, the idea of performing, but also it's a high degree of difficulty to pull off something that is on its face purposely fake, but you need that fakeness to feel authentic. And that is just like an incredible thing to pull off.
Yeah, I agree completely. But I would also say that this episode certainly has its layers of cringe and so on. But I would say that it is more what I would call sad cringe. The episode made me really sad, as opposed to, you know, the previous episodes that were like still very funny and outrageous, but also cringe. I don't know if you're aware of this, Patrick Klepek, but there is a subreddit on Reddit called Cringe. Mm-hmm. And then there's a separate one called Sad Cringe. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not, but I believe you. I believe you.
So there's Cringe, which is like what they do is they repost people's social posts online, mm-hmm. and they're like, oh, this person's really cringy. And then Sad Cringe is the same thing, except it makes you cringe and you're sad, you know?
Is it necessarily producing a layer of empathy, or is it just sad cringe? Like, do you feel for the person? It, like, I feel like the difference between cringe, like, cringe, you rarely feel necessarily like, ooh, like, I can understand, I, you know, like, I feel for this person in this moment. More, it's just, ah, this person in this moment. So, and does sad cringe cross over into empathy?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think so because, like, when you see, like, sad cringe, you're watching a human suffer, right?
Right.
Like, you're watching somebody suffer in some way, in a really terrible way. And so, like, most humans will feel some core, deep level of empathy as a result of the sad cringe, you know? So, you know, like, on cringe, I'll just give you a difference in cringe, right? So, like, there was a viral video of this woman this week doing a sort of fashion show type runway walk. And then it's revealed when the camera pans over that she's at a guy's funeral, you know?
To be fair,
I believe the guy designed her dress, so it wasn't like completely
right.
Outrageous.
Okay.
So it was, but it was like shocking to see like this woman do these poses and then get some photos taken and then walk over to the open casket. Like that was very
well. She shared it right on right. It's yeah, one it was, thing to be shared in a like with a group
well, I don't
of
know.
Friends.
I don't know if she shared. I don't know if she shared it, but yeah, it was posted online. But
oh, okay.
Being,
oh,
the point being, you watch it and you're like, oh wow, that makes me uncomfortable. So that's like. Kind of a pretty classic cringe. That's like a very, but you don't feel bad for that person. You know,
no,
like you're, no. that's just like a classic stereotypical platonic ideal of cringe. Okay. Here is a post on sad cringe. And the subject line of this post is incel complains about Bumble's feature where women initiate the chat. So it appears to be a repost of a Reddit thread. And this guy made a Reddit comment. It looks like a Reddit comment, I think, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment reads as follows, okay? Bumble, isn't that the one where the women have to contact the men? Every time I hear that premise, it makes me laugh. Make an app for something the majority of women refuse to do. Make the first move. I don't understand how it stays in business. Lots of desperate guys, I guess, willing to pay the fees. End quote. that is sad cringe because you're
okay.
Like that's sad.
That's
right?
The good
like,
stuff.
That's a, yeah. I mean that is the good stuff. Inject that into my veins. So anyway, this episode was sad cringe, right? Like
a lot of the other
episodes have been cringe. This one was sad cringe, where you cringe in a sad way. And so I appreciate that it's giving us many different flavors of cringe, and this one's just a lot sadder. But yeah, you know, that's like the guy's kind of sounds like a jerk who's making that comment on the sad cringe subreddit, but also you feel a little bit bad for him that he's mm-hmm. so oblivious and out of touch, you know. Like you get a full glimpse of what that guy's life has been like through that one.
You can start making some assumptions and some some guesses about other opinions
right.
this person
right.
might have.
Other opinions, other experiences they may or may not have had.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, episode 3 of The Curse, sad cringe. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
All right, let's talk about what actually happens in this episode, Patrick Klepek. The episode opens on Asher counting piles of cash. Then entering an auction to buy plots of land featuring broken down houses ready for a teardown, Asher ends up bidding on and winning a house for $62,500, only for Whitney to ask why he went above their budget of $40,000. Let's pause here for a moment. I think, you know, obviously what happens with the house is going to be like a long running theme. My sense is I don't fully comprehend the details of their scheme yet.
Well, we didn't get into this in, I believe, the first episode before the Cherry Tomato Boys begin having their conversation.
Yeah, before that derailed our whole train of thought. Yeah.
But one of the conversations that Whitney's father has with Asher is, hey, I don't really kind of believe in the way the two are choosing to spend your money. And Asher reveals the broad idea that they have is to buy plots of land with homes that are like stressed, teardowns, and that they'll build these new properties on them, these climate homes. And then with the show is going to like raise these neighborhoods up. And so they don't really care about the houses. They care about the plots of land. And so like they're going to inspire new development in these neighborhoods. And thus through their personal appearances in this show, hyping up this neighborhood, these styles of houses, like finances raise all boats, including the plots of land. And so they're buying up distressed plots of land, distressed houses, in the idea that their show, their success, their fame will lead to a bunch of money down the road. Almost assuredly, none of that will happen. And I think we're getting like, you know, presumably they're getting a bunch of this money from Whitney's family. So she's explicitly profiting, like using the profits of these slumlords in order to like finance her like good slumlording, like ethical slumlording that they're playing out. And the idea that they had a budget and he went well above that. Cause in that scene, you get a real sense that he's like got a sense of power. Like he feels cool. Like he knows these people and he knows he's got enough money that if he wants it, he can get it. Even if he probably shouldn't have.
Right. I also get the sense that he's not really spending quote unquote his money a little bit.
Oh,
right?
No,
right.
I think this is Whitney's family's money.
Yeah. But also, it basically feels like a little bit sketchy what they're doing.
Right? Uh-huh.
A little bit. I don't think it's like technically illegal anything they're doing, but like buying distressed properties and then using your reality show to pump the values up in order to then sell them at a profit. It feels like
a pump and dump, which we've heard, like, you know, dump, when right. talked yeah. about things like crypto and meme stocks, but it feels disingenuous at best. And there are other ways to describe it at worst, which I think the show is increasingly heading towards the at worst description.
Well, the thing is, we all know that this plan is the one minor bummer is we all know it's doomed. Like, there's no, I don't think there's any doubt in our mind that it's going to fail, right? So, but you know, in a different show, you might be like, oh, maybe they're going to get the HGTV show. It's like, no, there's no way. It's never going to happen. So I don't know. Who knows? Maybe prove me wrong, show. Prove me wrong. But it does feel like he is way in over his head. And I guess the quote unquote pleasure of the show is watching him being hoisted by his own petard. Anyway, we are then interrupted by the start of a video. Dougie's brought a recording of a focus group responding to an early edit of Asher and Whitney's show. The response isn't good and especially focuses on how deeply unfunny and uncharismatic Asher is. Dougie believes it might be an indication that HGTV might not want to pick up the show, which leads to a lot of anxiety between the three of them over what they could do to improve the show. Although one positive takeaway from the focus group is an argument between two people about climate change, which Whitney and Asher take to mean the show contains a good message. This is a great scene and classic Nathan Fielder. The thing that really haunts me about this scene is when they say, you know, the focus group people say, oh, yeah, the guy is not funny at all. I mean, he's not hot. He's not funny. At least be hot or funny. That's all I ask for
my lane.
That's all I ask for my people I watch on TV is be hot or funny. And Nathan Fielder's character, Asher, says, that's so ridiculous. I'm hilarious. And then like Emma Stone turns around and like, it's like, yeah, and she like kind of smiles and laughs and then literally turns around and like is completely stone faced right afterwards. It was an amazing performance of like kind of the side she shows Asher and then what she really is feeling and thinking at the time. Any other reflections on the focus group scene, Patrick Lepik?
Two things. One, the short one is you mentioned earlier about Emma Stone, that like the show in particular being a real showcase for Emma Stone's like acting capabilities. And there is an all-time line read in this scene, which is when Dougie goes and fetches some blueberries from the fridge, sits down. Clearly she doesn't want him to sit down, worried that you're going to get these on a white couch, like fumbles a blueberry. Clearly it gets into the couch and the way she says like, "Oh, it's okay. Like I shouldn't have even tried doing it." Like, like if there's a way that you can find this scene, isolate it, like her reading of the, like, "It's okay" is just masterful. It's operating on like 900 different levels. And it's just there's so many ways you could have done that line. And in many worlds, you don't do the version that Emma does, but the way she delivers it is just like a masterclass. Like, it is just unbelievably good. And I delighted in it. The other thing is I found myself haunted by this scene. And I'm sure you're familiar with this feeling to a degree, in which, I came on my line of work as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then my career has shifted into much more audio, video, personality focused, because that's where the audience has gone. That's just how people like to, writing is still like vital and important, but it is definitely lower on the ranks in terms of like where the broad audience has gone. So I've had to adapt what I do and what my strengths are to like fit the audience to keep doing this work. What you invite when you shift to that is the fact that people are going to judge you on metrics that are beyond just what you say. It's how you say it. It can be something as simple as you say "like" too often, something you would never notice in just casual conversation. It can be, you know, when I was in my early days at Giant Bomb, like had some issues with like pimples and the sort, and like people would actively just like talk and make fun of that stuff. Now they're talking to themselves. Like, it's not like it's in front of me. No one's throwing it at me. But like when you're seeking out commentary on your work as like a form of validation or like feedback on how you're doing, what you end up realizing is people are going to talk about you in like the very ways that happened to Asher here. And so despite the fact that Asher is not a particularly likable character, I did find like the sad cringe here to be one in which there's where I found my empathy, David, was like, I have been in those situations in like the early awkward days where I was figuring out how to present myself on camera and like how I felt comfortable and how to find my own strengths in those mediums. And the process of doing that is a lot of people going like, "You're not very good at this. I couldn't be funny or hot. I couldn't pick a lane. I just sucked at it, David." And then like, hopefully I've arrived at a place where I suck a little bit less, but I definitely found myself in watching that focus group video being like, "Yeah, Asher, like, been there, bro. Like, yeah, I felt that." So it was an interesting spot to be, even if I don't know that necessarily that's what the show was going for in terms of its relatability.
All right, first of all, hold on. Note to self, stop forwarding Patrick all the emails about his acne. Let me check that off the list. And let me actually suggest something. If you ever feel... And I'm speaking to our audience here, Patrick. If you ever feel like your self-esteem is a little bit too high, a little bit too strong, if you feel like you have a little bit too much confidence in the old confidence tank there, go viral on TikTok. Oh. Try going viral on TikTok, because people will point out physical attributes you didn't even know you had.
Like, most of us are aware of our like weaknesses or what people would perceive as flaws, like things that we know and like have a weight on us. Like the struggles I've had with acne over the years. Like, when I look in the mirror, motherfucker, like, I know, like, I see it, like, it sucks. I've tried all the creams. Thanks. But the idea that people would find new ones to make fun of you and destroy you for, that is a curse in and of itself. I have not gone through that. That sounds awful.
You go viral on TikTok and people will say things like, "Hey, wow, it's so weird to see a video where one guy's right eye is like like so much higher than his left eye. And I'm like, what is that? Is that a thing that I like that I have? Like now I need to look in a mirror and check on that, you know, like, you know, they will reveal to you facts about yourself that you never otherwise need. So, I think that's what's going on with Asher here. Anyway. Well, I'm really glad you powered through that, Patrick, and are here to be able to share your insights with us today. So, by the way, since we are really digressing, I noticed the first, I have to say it's a little bit odd. Like, I don't think we really see explicitly what happens with the blueberry spilling. Like,
I rewound it a couple of times. I think we hear it. Okay.
We hear it. I think, and we see like some movement and we see the reaction to it. I think the show has chosen purposefully to not have a lot of coverage on the per scene is my guess, you know? And what I mean by that, what I mean by coverage is in a typical scene, you might have 2 to 3 cameras shooting the action and then you can cut between them to like put together the scene. It really doesn't feel like they use that much coverage of any given scene. Feels like they have like a kind of medium to wide shot and let things play out. And it's like, hey, and if it doesn't capture the right moment, then or the right thing, you know, because there's very few like cutaways to close-ups, right? Like, it does happen sometimes. Like, I'm not saying it's never happened, but most of the show is just long continuous shots. And so that was a moment where this is a moment where we would cut to, like in a normal show, this is a moment where we would cut to close up of him spilling blueberries on the couch. But like, we didn't get that.
Like to behind the scenes, you know, you and I are watching this through screeners provided by Showtime. And the great, very like, love the fact that we're able to like prep and watch all this early. We appreciate that, but they are in 1080p. And so I'm wondering, in the 4K version of Paramount Plus, like, can you see the blueberry? I'm going to have to go back and look. I'm going to reinvestigate this. If you're like, can I pause in the highest of definitions? Can I see the blueberry move?
He also used a jar to put the blueberries in. And I realized I've never seen that.
Usually you do that for like a yogurt parfait sort of situation, right? Put in some more options, but
I use a bowl for my blueberry consumption. Yeah. I don't know about you, because a jar, it's just awkward to
put your kind of gotta get your finger. You might squish the blueberry on the way down.
Exactly. Terrible. So that's the biggest sign that Dougie's a monster. Is he uses a jar to eat his blueberries? Okay, we've spent way too long talking about this scene. Let's move on. We cut to a classroom featuring the girl Asher interacted with in the parking lot. Two girls seem to be making fun of her. After class, she walks home with her sister and they chat about Roblox. At home, the two hear a knock at the door and panic as someone begins drilling a hole in the door's lock. And when the door opens, it's Asher. The house he bought, it turns out, is this one. The two girls sprint away, followed by Asher waving a $100 bill. He's eventually stopped by an extremely large man concerned for the two girls' safety. Later, Asher talks to the police and explains he owns the house, and it's revealed the family living here have been squatting. Let's just pause here for a moment. I mean, this is kind of classic Nathan Fielder antics, I would say, is putting his character in a situation where he needs to awkwardly explain something to someone he really shouldn't have to explain this to. But I did think that was a nice moment of him, like, you know, there's many horror movie elements in the show, and there's like a lot of cool moments where like the girl hears the drilling at the door and she seems like she knows what to do in that situation. She like goes, I think she grabs like a binder and then like runs out. And so I think they're not unprepared for this set of circumstances, but it was a little bit of a surprise when Nathan Fielder shows up. I didn't think it would be that house.
No, me either. And I thought they did a good job. Looking back on the show, like you and I talking about it now, fairly obvious, like setup and payoff. Like it actually makes a lot of logical sense that this is where the show was going. But I think it's especially a compliment to the filmmaking, where the moment that drill starts coming through, it gets really tense, really fast. And it wouldn't be all that tense if I had made the assumption in the moment, like, well, Asher's on the other side. Like, he's not going to, like, he's going to be weird, but, like, he's not, as far as I know, in the show, not a danger to these girls. And the way it's, again, these like tight shots, these long shots, like as that drill is coming through, it's the panic in the girls that ends up disarming you as the viewer into not making the logical conclusion that Asher is a reasonable person to be on the other side of that. Because the way they rush, like, oh, they've done this before. Like they've been through something, whether at this house or a different house, like who can say? And I thought it was a real tip of the hat to the show, where like it disarmed my brain long enough to be like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. That I was able to be sit with the emotions of those characters in the moment as it was setting up the payoff.
Yeah. And I'll just give you some life advice. Never run after children waving a $100 bill. Like, it's just, it's never going to end well. Like, there's no way that ends well. So just like keep that advice in mind. Okay. Learn from Ash's mistakes.
Slow down, girls. Slow down. Oh my God.
While chatting with a police officer, the family returns. So, and I'll just say before I actually continue, like the interaction he had with that guy felt very realistic to me. Like that felt like what a guy would do, like what a big dude would do if he found that.
It's like, I don't care what you're saying. Like, there's no explanation that works here.
There's nothing
here,
you can say,
buddy,
that would be okay. Anyway, while chatting with a police officer, the family returns home. The father reveals he was at one point writing rent checks, only to realize they weren't being cashed, so he stopped writing them. Asher says the previous owner was in tax trouble, revealing why things likely got strange. The officer offers to help Asher evict the tenants immediately, but Asher offers to let them stay. Asher then passes on this revelation to Whitney, and the two decide to let them stay and improve the home. Whitney seems surprised by Asher's decision and wishes the focus group saw this side of him. Asher also has to keep inventing new lies to explain his interactions with the family. I love that part because you realize, oh, right, he had lied about it. He had lied about meeting them before. So, like, it's really blowing up in his face now when he's like, yeah, you know, they didn't even remember me when I saw them. It was really weird.
It was kind of weird. You know,
all over the place.
I think he's in the clear. I think by the end of this episode, in the, like, there's a very specific moment where we'll get there, where I expected, like, this is where it's all going to blow up in his face. And the show just kind of neatly resolves it and pivots to something else. And, because the escalation of those lies maybe could have gotten a little comical to a certain degree, and so, but I enjoyed this other like not twist where he has to be like, yeah, I guess I just don't remember getting $100. You know, their lives are complicated.
A few other things happen, and then we can talk about kind of the big climactic sequence. But the two meet up with Dr. Brown. There's a really awkward interaction where like, he gives her the injection, and then they talk about when they can have sex again. Dougie says, asks if Asher wants to hang out, but Asher declines, and we see Dougie in a hotel room with plates and empty drinks, and he starts to cry. And then...
Can we pause the Dougie thing for a second? Because, so we didn't talk about this, but in the previous episode, Asher finds Dougie in the casino. And multiple times, Asher has mentioned, like, well, you're still here. And there's also a moment where Dougie mentions that the HGTV didn't send the focus group tape. Mm. He requested it. And so there seems to be an undercurrent pointed out by Asher that like Dougie doesn't need to be here anymore. Like the stage that they're at in the show is waiting for a green light from the network to make more of the show. And that Dougie at this point could have left, go back to LA, work on the edit, and wait for the sign from the network. And so the fact that he's here in the casino, he asks Asher, do you want to hang out? Like, you want to get a drink? And here he asks Asher, do you want to hang out? Like, I'm nearby. He specifically says, I'm walking near your house. Like, I'm just out on a walk. Do you want to hang out? And it's revealed that he's in a hotel room with food and like empty like beer bottles and like starts to cry. It's an odd, maybe that's going to be revealed to like, as you've noted, Dougie's past history with Asher, of which we know very little, but just sort of odd where he's like desperate to have a friend and keeps getting rebuffed by Asher at like every opportunity to like create a connection outside of the context of the show.
Dougie seems like a very sad individual. And I think that's one of the things that the show plays with is you have, you know, after the first episode, we think, oh, wow, Dougie, that's a complete asshole, like terrible person, you know, not nice, doesn't have good taste. But then when you find out, like, he's really sad and has sad things in his history, it's like, oh, you feel bad for him. You know, people aren't just one thing. People aren't just one thing. Anyway, Whitney and Asher pull up to the coffee store that was one of their local partners and discover that it's closed. It turns out the agreement they had for the coffee shop and a jean store next door didn't explicitly require them operating outside the production of the show, so they aren't. It also means the person we met in the Curse's very first episode, the very first shot, Fernando, no longer has the job they guaranteed. Whitney calls Fernando up and offers to pay them as a plaza security guard. There are others without jobs, though, and while Whitney wonders if they should do a GoFundMe to help cover the cost, Asher brushes the idea away, deeming it not urgent. I think the whole Fernando subplot is, and probably what's going to happen with the kids in the house, is just a sign that often well-meaning liberal progressives can actually do a lot of damage in the process of trying to do something good.
What does it mean to help, right? I think that is like a central question of the show. And like what it means to help is not actually help. It's not systemic aid to people.
Right. I think they, you know, Whitney and Asher conceive of help as these big showy flashes, like flashy showings of assistance of we got you a job and we got you a this and we got you that. And it's not actually what's most helpful. What's most helpful is showing up day after day, week after week, for years, over a long period of time, and not just like, hey, we got you a job for 3 weeks that you weren't particularly well suited for, you know, which can actually be bad because there's opportunity costs that the person's not looking for other jobs. It creates more disruption in their life. And by the way, I just want to put this out there. Like, I don't think that the disruption is over yet. Like, I think something terrible is going to happen. Like, Fernando's going to have to kill someone.
He's got that gun. And he mentions over the phone, because they didn't seem, Whitney didn't seem to care when he was the security guard. Yeah. They just wanted to funnel money to him. And he's like, well, I'll do it at night. That's when he says, like, the freaks or weirdos come out. And presumably he's going to meet one of them. And that is going to go awry. I think that's a very.
Yeah.
Very obvious outcome for the arc of that character.
And then like it will end up complicating the whole situation even further. And
right. Yeah. And even Asher, you know, to your point about like sort of the milquetoast ideas from like quote unquote progressives in terms of offering solutions, like Asher offers this family to stay in the home. And then Whitney gets it in her head. Well, then we should try and fix up the home a little bit. And like, let's put in like, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 or something like that. Clearly, like, they have enough money that, like, they can just do things like that. And he, over the course of like a couple of minutes, whittles down how much they should spend from like $5,000 to $3,000 to $2,000 to like, well, I mean, $500 would go a long way. You know what I mean? And to counter that against, he had a budget of $40,000, buys a distressed house for $60,000 plus, while also brushing off the GoFundMe as not being, quote, urgent, and obviously that's because Fernando's in the show, right? They may have guaranteed other jobs, but like, he is a primary character in this pilot, so of course they got to take care of him. But these other people, well, I don't know about these other people. Hopefully the system will all lift them up when the neighborhood gets better because we get famous. And so you see a lot of evidence of Asher pulling similar sorts of stunts, and I think makes a lot of sense why they were successful in being exploitative at a casino.
indeed. So anyway, the couple arrives at the new house they bought. They meet the family. They do not seem all that excited to greet them, and the father constantly worries about that they're just going to take the house. Whitney tries to bond with the two girls and apologizes for Asher's behavior in the parking lot, and the girls reveal his actions are why they tiny cursed him, which is riffing on a TikTok trend where people curse others and hope that banal annoying things happen to them, like your shoes getting untied. In this case, Asher was tiny cursed with having his chicken taken away. When Asher inquires further, the girl reveals she specifically took the chicken away from spaghetti, which is remarkably close to the actual food Asher ordered that did not come with any chicken. Specifically, it was chicken penne.
Yeah.
The revelation unnerves Asher, who wonders if the girls have been stalking them. All right, let's pause here for a moment. I want to say, by the way, I believe it is it Barkhad Abdi who is in this show? Yes.
Yeah, he definitely struck me as familiar. I couldn't pin
Barkhad Abdi is the Somali American actor who plays the father character of the girls in the house. Mm-hmm. But he is best known for his breakout performance as Abdulwali Muse in the 2013 film Captain Phillips.
Okay. All right.
He's also been immortalized in the online meme. Mm-hmm. Look at me. I am the captain now, which mm-hmm. is like, you know, there's a reason that has had staying power over all these years is because it's one of the best lines and line deliveries in a modern movie.
It is a top 10 meme. Like, it is in the pantheon it has survived its like pop culture moments, and like exactly. That's when you know it's a good meme.
So many people use that meme who have never seen Captain Phillips.
100%.
I know this because I like Captain Phillips, but very few people I know have actually watched that movie.
I have. I liked it as well, but it was not good enough. But I mean, such is the nature of a meme. It's outside of its context. It's like the movie was good, not good enough to justify a meme like existing for the better part of a decade. But that like that performance absolutely is within the film.
Yeah. Yeah. So great stuff here. One thing I really appreciated about this was afterwards, you see Asher looking at TikTok, the tiny curse trend on TikTok. And I don't know if you've ever been around a person who is looking through a trend on TikTok, but it sounds literally exactly the same as what he was doing with his phone in this scene, where he basically has the TikTok up and then he's swiping through and you hear the same sound, and then you hear like the first 3 seconds the same sound again, and the first and so on and so forth. It's like, oh wow, they really captured what it's like to like be obsessed with the trend on TikTok, which mm-hmm. I appreciated. Any other thoughts before we get to the final scene, Patrick?
No, but they really play between the filmmaking and the performances. The dancing is fine. Like when it's revealed that she says spaghetti, and like the horror that comes over Nathan Fielder's face, and the way the music kicks in, and the slow zoom, like it's all these elements of the show coming together. It's still while I maintain, like, I don't know, man, maybe she's got powers. Like maybe he has been it's such a great moment. And that contrasted with Whitney's like just performative empathy, fakeness, just so many good things happening. The way that she goes up back, well, I'm looking at these broken windows and like, of course you can stay here for free. And then, you know, the father says, can you get that in writing? So, well, I don't do the contracts. And it's like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, like just so many.
Well, she doesn't even like understand why he might. Right. Why that might be important to him.
Good for him for asking, though. Right. It was like, this guy is no dummy. Like, yeah,
yeah.
Get that in writing if you can from Asher.
Yeah. I don't foresee it going well. Everything, is there anything that we think is going well in the show at all? You know, like, I don't know.
No,
like,
I do. I wondered, you know, there was a moment where they were concerned about like a water leakage or some water damage on the ceiling. And I think Whitney's concerned about it. And Asher says, oh, it's not as bad as I feared. Maybe that I'm just like in the way I was in the overseas, like I'm looking for landmines. I'm like, is that one of them? Like, mm-hmm. is that like water damage?
Is that going to go off later? Yeah. Is that going to be a problem? Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the concluding the climax of the episode is, Whitney helps Asher to help her remove a sweater whose zipper has gotten stuck. They end up stretching and pulling the sweater to the point that Asher falls over. The two begin laughing hysterically, prompting Whitney to believe that this side of Asher is the one people need to see more of. So they try and fail to recreate the scene for Whitney's Instagram. Meanwhile, Asher cannot shake wondering how the children knew about the chicken missing from the food order. The obsession pisses off Whitney, who accuses Asher of being judgmental. Asher recoils and wishes Whitney would validate his feelings while he's talking. The two go back and forth over who's being more racist, and this prompts an enormous fight. During the fight, Asher reveals that he said the sentence that Lisa told us to, suggesting the two have been to couples therapy. The fight ends with Whitney realizing the whole argument was caught on camera. She ends the escalation by saying both of our feelings are valid and rewatches the fight while she's in bed. I also think she deleted the file, is what I could sense.
She did. I was on pins and needles on whether, because the show has, like, you know, Dougie has been like, hey, like the tension between, like, we gotta get something here. Like, mm-hmm. what is the hook on the show? It's not the houses. It's not the people you're helping. It's not the neighborhood. It's like, do you guys hate each other? Where's like the sexual tension, as was pointed out in the focus group? And I was like, I think it's a coin flip on whether she like posts that as a Instagram story or something like that as a way of juicing interest in the two of them. And obviously she hits delete,
but it just, she when you delete something,
it. She thinks when, about it.
When you delete something, it goes into your recently deleted folder where it stays for 30 days. And by the way, this is a show that I think actually is sophisticated enough that it would know that you can recover those files.
Well, and it's also, it's choosing, I don't know how, maybe you get like legal leeway because like they're popular, like pop culture, but like they're using TikTok and Instagram, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not, lots of shows, movies will use fake services so they can get UI that will remind you of services that you use in your life, but they're not actually going to like properly emulate or get the rights or however that ends up working out. Maybe it's like a form of satire where they're able to use it, but whatever the case, they're clearly deeply aware, as you pointed out, with like the aesthetics of scrolling through a trend. Like, they understand how these platforms work. And so even if they don't actually end up having her unearth that file, I do think it's a testament to the show's like credibility on like the devices, the platforms, the social networks that they're including and referencing, that all of that is on the table because they understand how all these devices and platforms work, and thus could be potential avenues for the plot and the story in a way that I would not necessarily feel in a show that like, you know, came up with a fake Instagram just because they wanted to like show a photo based social network. So I think it's an interesting part of the show that you're pressing on.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a sad cringe part of the episode.
Yeah.
You know, huge bummer. And, you really feel Asher's pain when he says, "I said the sentence that Lisa told us to."
That one. My heart actually sunk. This is not like in a show where that happens all that often. You're not necessarily rooting against these characters. They don't seem like villains necessarily, even if they're deeply, deeply flawed. But that moment, like, it suddenly was a window into their relationship that really deepened Asher as a character and the kind of like day-to-day pain that we don't quite understand yet, but as you said, like, has been a common theme of the show, we don't know the sadness that people carry inside them.
Yeah. It's just such a great line. I said the sentence that Lisa told. There's so much in that line. A, they've been seeing couples counseling. B, like, he's making a good faith effort to try to use his training. C, like, Emma Stone's character, Whitney, has in some ways violated or not operated in good faith, or maybe she's just too emotional in the moment to do so. But yeah, D, these are just people who are like talking past each other. They're not meeting each other at all in the middle and what they each need in the moment. And that's just really sad to see at any time. I also thought the part about them trying to recreate how, like, the spontaneity of the first moment was just so painful. Like, and it's not like I haven't done anything like that before, you know, like where I've done, I've made a Instagram reel or a TikTok and then, oh, like that, I want to fix this. And I've redone it and like had the same emotional reaction, you know?
Yeah.
But I also have a self-awareness of what I'm doing. And I think that, like, you know, them trying to make something lighthearted and fun and authentic, it's really difficult to try to manufacture authenticity, which is what they're trying to do here. And it's very difficult for somebody trying to manufacture authenticity for that performance to feel authentic, which it does, you know, like per the point I made earlier on in the podcast. So, really, really painful. Really painful sequence overall. You know, I was thinking, oh, hey, so before getting to this point, I was thinking, oh, this hasn't been that bad. This hasn't been excruciating as previous episodes. And then we get to this scene and it's really, really awful all around. I will also say it does capture, you know, like in a relationship that's very challenging, often things can go from really lighthearted to extremely toxic really fast. And I think that this captures that kind of sense as well. So yeah, just a lot to feel sad about here, Patrick Klepek. Any other thoughts before we wrap up here today?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, where in many ways I think what this scene reveals is the like lack of authenticity in their own relationship. Like, I think one fundamental question that is not answered so far is, why are you guys together? Like, what's the attraction, interest, overlap? Like, what made any of this happen in the first place? Like, I don't, you don't get a, yes, the focus group is cruel and it's like judging a person on a personal level through a performance in a reality show. But at the end of the day, like, there's a through line, right? Like, there's a lack of authenticity from these characters. And I think that extends to their relationship as well, that I suspect is going to be something that the show continues to interrogate further. And I'm deeply interested to find out, like, clearly they, maybe not clearly, but the relationship meant enough to both sides, one side to go to therapy, like to try and rescue it, to try and repair it, to try and find tools to talk to each other instead of past each other. But they've also only been married a year, right? So, like, how long has this relationship been going on? Is this sort of like people who have been dating for a very long time, thus had to get couples therapy? And then, I don't know, it just invites a lot of questions about a show that, if I had to pick one word, like, what is this show about? And, like, authenticity would be one of those words that I would use to describe, like, a broad thematic underpinning of The Curse as a whole. And I think now we're realizing how deeply that extends to even just Asher and Whitney's interactions when no one is watching. Even as Whitney is someone who is always thinking about, but what if someone was? And that introduces all sorts of interesting complications that I'm sad, cringely interested to see play out in the episodes ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple more thoughts, but why don't we let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week, Patrick Klepek?
They can follow me and all the stuff I do about video games over at remapradio.com and the associated podcast Remap Radio. And my regular gaming and parenting newsletter, Crossplay, is over at crossplay.news.
Podcast.decodingtv.com is where you can find my this podcast and episodes of it, and also become a paid member at decodingtv.com. I pay everyone who contributes to Decoding TV, whether they're making videos, whether they're co-hosting podcasts with me, and it's because of people's contributions at decodingtv.com that that's possible. So if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider becoming a paid member at decodingtv.com. All right. Closing thoughts here. I do want to say, like, I think, you know, my speculation in the first episode is Asher is one of the only people that will go along with Whitney's stuff. Like, and maybe he's one of the only people that's going to enable what Whitney is trying to do.
Yeah, he's a useful tool. I think that's right.
But I think you're right that the show has not explicitly explained, like, the whole history of that relationship yet. So, like, probably some shoes left to drop. But that's my assumption, is that he's the only guy that would put up with her stuff and or would, you know, support her in this quixotic vision that she has. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're together. And that's not a great foundation for a relationship, because she clearly doesn't respect him in many ways. So, okay. The episode ends with Fernando showing up his nighttime security gig with a chair and a gun. The final shot has him shuffling around the parking lot before looking at the camera. Kind of a weird moment, because people don't look at the camera in the show very much.
Well, the first episode ends with Asher looking at the camera. So
yeah,
I don't
but
know
that was like, it was like a camera. Was it a camera in the universe of the show that he was looking at, though, in that scene?
I don't. Maybe. I can't remember explicitly. But it's at least that one was a he was staring forward. Like, it was a much more like I'm looking at you, the viewer sort of thing, where this one is just like out of nowhere, like, what? And then the show just cuts.
Or it doesn't cut. It, like, freeze frames, if I recall correctly.
Yes, so, correct.
Weird moment. You know, very, very goofy, but we'll see. Maybe it's an homage to something that we're not aware of. And if you happen to know, let us know at decodingtv@gmail.com. Patrick Klepek, any other thoughts on this episode?
I think Fernando needs to get the fuck out of that parking lot. That's what I
think. Do not associate with these people. Not associate with these people.
I think the curse is actually, Whitney and Asher. David. That's what I think.
They're the real curse. I did enjoy Whitney going full Karen mode early on when she finds out the coffee shop has been shut down.
Yes.
Like, we've rarely seen her that animated and enraged.
You didn't think that was a reason to call me? But like, that I will say, the fully enjoyable, I agree with you 100%. But then that conversation, which was itself cringy, like, well, the spirit of the agreement, and like, oh, that phrasing like unnerves me to like to no end of like, well, the contract doesn't say.
Do you have experience with organizations making promises that they don't keep?
I might have, yes, you know, the day before recording this, like, filled out a proof of claim form so that I can claw back the rest of the severance a company may or may not have owed me. So yeah, the spirit of the agreement was that you give me my severance. Like, what if we didn't?
But the letter of the agreement, it doesn't say anything about that. So
bankruptcy courts?
Yeah. Anyway, the show continues to be great. We hope you're enjoying it. We hope you're enjoying our coverage of it right here on Decoding TV. We'll continue it throughout the rest of the season. Thank you so much for listening. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. We'll see you next week for another episode of The Curse.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.